Everybody, my name is Philip. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for those great directions. We found our way. It's great. Got a few guys from our home group. So our home group is into action, and we're here from Richmond, Virginia. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I got plugged in Alcoholics Anonymous and got transformed. I've been sober since February 16th of 2002, so a little over 6 years. It's an amazing thing. I hope I get to the good part, which is the recovery. I'm going to tell you my story, because to be recovered and to have a life that really works now is really an exciting thing. And you know, talking about home groups and active home groups, to be plugged into an enthusiastic group of people that are really, you know, living it and not talking about it, because I wouldn't be able to last kind of pretending to do AA or going to meetings without, you know, seeing what was going on the rest of the other 23 hours of my day. You know, that didn't work for very long. But the reason I did all that stuff is, you know, first things first, I am an alcoholic. Let me try to establish that for you a bit. I found out that I was an alcoholic when I got sober, ironically. And when I got sober, I found out that there was alcoholism in my family. Interestingly, this secret disease affected my family for countless generations that I had no idea about. I just look at, you know, one particular person as an example of alcoholism in my family, and that's my mother. She's not an alcoholic, but any relationship you can think of, like she's the granddaughter, the niece, the sister, the wife, the mother, anything, any relationship you can think of, she is of an alcoholic. So her brother's an alcoholic, her father, her son, her husband are all alcoholics. This is what happens in an alcoholic family. Growing up, I had no idea of this. I had no idea that my grandfather was an alcoholic. He was a guy who he died years before I was born, but he was just told to me as the guy who, you know, drank too much sometimes, crashed some cars, but, you know, but and he was definitely not an alcoholic. My cousin died a couple of years ago from alcoholism. And even to this day, I was already, you know, an example of someone who'd gotten sober in the family. I've been a couple of years sober. Even then, it was, how could this have happened? No one could understand alcoholism. That's how alcoholism affected my family. And I can't even trace it back further than a couple generations because this secret disease does not talk about itself. So I don't know what happened with my, even past my grandparents at all, really. I know growing up I was pretty high strung. I was wound tight. I remember being, looking back, I had this subjective memory of being happy until I went off to go to kindergarten. And that was a terrible, terrible thing. And getting along with the other kids was not as easy as it should have been. I was known as a snob. It was a high-strung family. My mom was a teacher, and she taught us how to read before we went off to kindergarten. And when I got there and found out the other kids didn't know how to read, it was a difficult relationship I had with those kids. And it was a hierarchical thing. I'm better than you or I'm worse than you. I will look at that all through my life now. I'm realizing that comparing myself to other people, I must have come across as an arrogant, arrogant little kid. I obviously must have, because I got beat up a lot and I didn't understand why. No idea why these kids were picking on me. These dumb kids were picking on me. So I had that relationship going on with other people. I must be better than you or worse than you or whatever. It was a difficult thing. But I was an intense kid. I was focused on school. Let me preface that by saying I was focused on school when I wanted to be. I liked to read. I liked certain subjects. I was not interested in what the teacher had to tell me if she was a moron. And a lot of my teachers were morons. I'm not sure, looking back, that they were. But, you know, I had this, what I call alcoholic now, you know, attitude towards my own life. I'm going to do what I want. you know, the reins were pretty tight. I ended up being a juvenile delinquent or anything like that. I was a little bit rebellious when it came to studying. I didn't do that kind of thing. But I ended up with good grades and good test scores and that kind of stuff. So my rebellion didn't go anywhere. And I realized that, you know, the alcohol in the back of everybody's head was a problem. I know that I had this sense of being overprotected from alcohol specifically. And so my real drinking story starts when I went away to college. I had a couple experiences in high school drinking. I remember one time I drank a lot and had this wonderful experience with the bed spinning around. I thought that was just the most amazing thing. You know, I was 16. So there's some indications that I, you know, was going to enjoy alcohol when I went away to college. So I was looking forward to that. And I spent my high school career, as I said, kind of doing what I wanted to do, but when I did, I was kind of intense about it. I wanted to be an orchestra musician in a symphony. And I spent my childhood, you know, from 10 years old, I started taking French horn lessons. I did that. I ended up going to the school where they had the best French horn players in the world, so I could do that. I went to the best school for that, Chicago, where I grew up, Chicago. And that was my intention, to go be an orchestral musician. And I went away to college and found alcohol. That was great. And 3 months later, I got my first grade. The grades came back. And I got a B minus in horn. And that was incongruous with my image of what things were supposed to be. I was supposed to be this intense person, driven and successful. And looking back, I understand that it had a lot to do with alcohol taking me away from, you know, what I wanted to do. I really was an alcoholic. I had this idea that I needed to be the best, and if I wasn't the best, I was going to quit. And once I quit, I needed to get back in because I made a rash decision. And also, I needed to be the best, but I didn't really have to practice as much as other people. I had this delusion, fueled by alcohol. So 3 months into, you know, I'm going to say 18 years old when I started drinking, 3 months later, I quit my now 8-year lifelong dream of being an orchestra musician. I quit the school of music and found something easier and softer and became a pre-med. And so so I did that. And the next year, I'm just regretting my decision to quit the school of music. I begged my way back in, and I ended up doing that through college. I balanced those two things: am I pre-med, am I music major? What am I? What do I want to be when I grow up? And I can see clearly now what I was doing. What I was doing, I was making excuses. I was telling people in the pre-med world, well, the reason I'm not quite as good as you is because I'm spending all my time doing this music stuff, and vice versa with the music people. Well, you don't understand me, how talented I am. I'm doing the pre-med stuff too, and that explains why I'm not quite as successful as you are in the music world. And I was drinking a lot. I was drinking more and more. And it really kind of took hold of me very quickly. And looking back, it really, you know, there was a lot of warning signs that I had no idea about. Like I said, my family warned me about alcohol to the extent of stay away from it if you can. And that was it. There's no idea of any alcohols in the family. I do remember when I went away to college, so the one thing my mom told me about alcohol is, I know you're going to drink, so drink vodka instead of beer. It won't gain as much weight. So I kind of had a very fairly typical alcoholic progression. By the end of 5 years, and I'm graduating with a couple degrees, I needed a reset. I needed a new chance in life. I kind of burned some bridges. I hadn't really destroyed anything, and I got that opportunity. I applied to medical school, and I got in. And so, hey, a new life start. I got a choice between doing the music and the medicine. I decided to choose the medicine. And all right, so all these mistakes hitting under the rug. Nothing really too bad happened in college. There was the incident with the fight in the dorm. There were the embarrassing situations with the throwing up and the women that I should make amends to, but all that stuff is, I can push it under the rug. Nothing really seriously happened. I can make a fresh start, and I did. I had this girlfriend. I really wanted to eventually get married to in the summer before I went away to medical school. On the top of the world, I got this great girlfriend I'm really in love with. I'd been able to make a choice between music and medicine. I had both of those options open to me, and I was able to make the choice to go to medical school. And one thing that really made me so angry, my parents said, "Well, listen, you got one summer before you go out of medical school. We pay for your college. You owe us. Spend the summer with us." Spend the summer with my girlfriend. What are you talking about? This is almost my fiance. She's my pre-fiance. And I said, well, you know, they guilted me, and they basically said, you owe us. We paid for your college, and spend the summer with us. And I know, looking back, what they were doing. They wanted to see what the heck's going on with this guy. There's something wrong with him. And they had a chance to kind of look at me that summer, and my drinking was atrocious. I was hiding. They were going, I found 18 empty beer bottles in your closet. What is going on with you? And I was just drinking to the point where I was sitting in a chair, and not that drunk until I tried to get up, and then bang, my head real bad, and that didn't hurt too bad. I was drinking a lot. I was drinking all the time, and it was really out of control. And there was some emotional stuff coming up, kind of welling up from my childhood. What was going on in my early childhood? I don't know. There's something going on. I can't figure out. There's some trauma. I don't know what's going on. And I never was able to sort that out. All I remember from that summer is it was a bad summer, and I resented my parents for the next 10 years for taking away that opportunity to be with this girl who said, well, you decided to be with your parents instead of me, and you decided to go to medical school instead of me, so I'm out of here. And by the way, you're an alcoholic. I did get a chance to go to medical school. That's where the first true confrontation with my alcoholism was unavoidable. I was able to kind of skate my way through undergrad, studying the night before the test and doing the paper the night before it was due, and just kind of telling myself that I was just a typical college student, drinking to excess, and now I need a plug. And I didn't. I wasn't able to study. When it came to actual, learning stuff that you can't fake, you can't use your intelligence to make up anatomy. The anatomy is anatomy, and you got to know it. You can't just be smart. it was a tough thing. So that first year, I remember as completely hopeless. It was absolutely miserable. I was very depressed. Let me describe a little bit how I felt on a typical night. I would feel the urge to drink. It would be welling all day long. I'd feel guilty about it. I know I need to push. I've been pushing my whole life. I really have worked hard. Looking back, I've worked my way into medical school. I've truly worked hard in my life. Done a lot of things. But I gotta do it. I gotta focus. But let me just have a few drinks. I just can't avoid that feeling. I need to, something. A few drinks in me, and I'm okay. I'm all right. So, but I got to drink some more. So what I've done now is I've got this pattern where I know that I'm going to not be able to stop. So I'm going to the store, and I'm buying a 12-pack. Beer, the wine equivalent or liquor or whatever. If it was beer, it'd be a 12-pack. Because if I got any more than that, I would definitely not be able to wake up the next morning. Screw it, I'm hungover, I'm not going to school. If I stopped at 12, which I was occasionally able to do, I could at least wake up and show up in a wretched state at school the next day. More than that, it's going to be impossible. So I was by a 12-pack, and so limit, control my drinking. And almost every single time, I would have to go back out, and usually I'd have to drive to get there. So I would drive, because what I'd done is I'd chosen to limit myself to only 12. I get to, either quarter to 12 at night or beer number 11, and I need to go out and get some more. So I drove drunk as a direct result of trying to control my drinking. If I would have just got that 24-pack in the first place, I wouldn't have to go back out the second time. But then that's a true example of, inability to control my drinking, and repeated attempts. I knew I was trying my very hardest, and so I'm convinced that I couldn't have tried any harder to control my drinking. But I would come home and I would start drinking more and be okay. But the sense of what's going to happen tomorrow is tough. It's coming on me. And before I know it, I'm drunk. And I'm nostalgic, and I'm crying, and I'm calling up people from my past on the telephone. I was a pathetic drunk. I wasn't fun. I was isolated. I wasn't social. I was in my little apartment that I never even unpacked. And that first year, I unpacked to go to the next apartment the next year easily because I never unpacked in the first place. I was camping in my own apartment for a year. In a very nice apartment, because I splurged, be grandiose, and spent a lot of money on an apartment. This is going to be great. It's going to be good this time. And I just throw up, and I throw up in my laundry, and have to look through the laundry the next day that was not so dirty, didn't have any puke on it, that I could actually wear. It was pathetic. I was a hobo. I was truly homeless in my apartment. I was so sad. And at the end of that year, they told me I was failing, but they were going to give me an opportunity to repeat the entire year of medical school. They didn't mention alcoholism. They didn't mention why I was failing. They just, you know, you've got these grades. They're not good enough. We will give you another chance. And I knew that it was alcohol that was causing that problem. So I somehow managed. I repeated that whole year. It was a humiliating experience. I didn't want to tell anybody I'd failed. I had this idea about myself that things were going to go great for me. I was going to achieve great things, and I was just not the kind of person that would fail. I mean, my God, I got into medical school. I'm not the kind of person who has to repeat a grade, you know. But I did. You know, I had to do that. I had to repeat a grade. It was, what grade is that? 21st grade. So, the next 4 years, it took me 5 years to graduate. It took me 5 years to get through undergrad, but I got 2 degrees out of it, so there's a reason for that. It took me 5 years to get through medical school, and there wasn't a good reason. I had to repeat it one of those grades. Those next 4 years, I don't remember very well. Let me try to say I don't remember. All I remember is utter hopelessness. I was plugged into a rut. I was more depressed than I can possibly describe. But I knew I couldn't. I'd already gotten so much debt, even though my parents paid for undergrad. I even just a year, 2 years, 3 years into medical school, I was already enough in the debt that I didn't have any marketable skills. I couldn't just go play the horn for a living at this point. You know, I couldn't be a hairdresser. There's nothing I could do other than I was stuck in this rut. I needed to pass. And my whole miserable existence was about how do I control my drinking enough that I'm at least able to see where that line is, what's the absolute bare minimum I need to do to pass, and I'll pass. And just that is survival mode for 4 years. It was beyond the idea that inevitably if I just keep this up, I'll graduate. It's like, no, I don't even conceive of that notion. All I can know is logically, if I keep going, there's no light at the end of the tunnel. Graduation is remote concept, but just keep going. It's more depression than I can possibly describe. But eventually, much to my surprise, that miserable existence, you know, finally did come to this point called graduation. And I was able to graduate. And just like before, other times, I was able to have a new reset button on my life. I graduated. I don't care if I'm the worst in my class. And I wasn't even the worst. I was somehow halfway between average and fail. I was right there on the 25th percentile. And, you know, but it was a poor existence. I was absolutely miserable. I was defensive all the time. I was constantly paranoid that I was going to be found out, that I was drinking all the time. You know, for a time I wish someone would have just confronted me and said I was an alcoholic, but the truth is they did. and I was unable to hear it. I was expending so much energy not letting someone approach me and tell me that I'm alcoholic. People would tell me I was alcoholic all the time. I can't say no one ever did. They did all the time. I just would not hear it because the idea of living with alcohol was worse than I could possibly imagine. So by now I've been drinking, 7 years. And I'm only halfway into my drinking. I drank for 15 years. I got sober when I was 33 years old. And just turned 40 a few months ago. Taking you through my drinking experience, it was getting worse. So then when I finally graduated, I got into a residency program, a chance for a new start. And I started off strong with good potential, recognized potential, and dropped off quickly. That was a pattern. But I was able to salvage the wreckage that brought by, I was able to finish that first year, the intern year, and I said, you can't finish the whole 3 years, but you can get credit for this year and transfer to somewhere else. You're out of here. I said, okay, fine. Give me credit. That's good. That's as good as anything. So I fell up. I got an opportunity to come to, this was brought me from Chicago to Richmond, where I got accepted into the medical school there as a resident in a very prestigious residency in oncology. You know, radiation treatment for cancer, that's very competitive. There's no way that I could have gotten into a program like that. Not with my grades or test scores or anything. I was less than mediocre at this point. But it happened. So I don't remember if I prayed or not by this time, because I don't know if I discovered the real power of prayer, but I had some sort of dabblings with it, and I was thinking, this is something. I didn't do this. I have been given a gift. I want to do something with this. I do not want to lose this. Like, I've been starting to lose everything. Finally, another chance. I don't want to lose it. So I'm in this radiation oncology program, and about 9 months in, they're saying to me directly, you're alcoholic. We have a program for people. We want you to stay, and we don't want to kick you out. You need to find a solution. And my response was, no, I'm not alcoholic. I just went 3 months without drinking. This is my desperate final acts. This is still 4 years before I got sober. I stayed sober for 3 months on sheer will. I want to stay in this program. I don't want to disappoint these people. I want my life to work. This is an opportunity of a lifetime. I don't want to screw this up. I did not drink for 3 months. It's the hardest thing. I can't imagine how I did it. So when they said, you're alcoholic, I said, I can't be alcoholic. It's weird. I'm not alcoholic. I didn't drink for the past 3 months. It's tough. But they said, you do have a problem, and you need to, if it's not alcoholism, you've got to figure out what your problem is and come up with a solution for it. And I did. I had a solution. I told them I had attention deficit disorder. I'm unable to focus on the task at hand, and found a sympathetic psychiatrist to take it one step further. So, well, if you have attention deficit disorder, what's your notes that you brought in clearly demonstrate that you do. You need Ritalin. So as I discovered Ritalin and discovered the research shows that certain minority of people require high doses of Ritalin, and I clearly fell into that category. And, and I was controlling my doctors and kind of manipulating them and basically got myself into a full-blown Ritalin addiction, which actually, for a year, I was able to not drink alcohol for an entire year. Another reason why I can't be an alcoholic. Cause, yeah, alcohol is really bad for me, I understand. But now that I found Ritalin, before the consequences happened of that, wow, I found a solution. So, even though I was convincing them to give me, a typical dose of 20 to 40 milligrams a day, and I was convincing them I need 200 milligrams a day, I was getting that. I was able to convince my doctors I needed that. Even though I was getting a month at a time of these 200 milligrams a day, I was still using it in about 6 days for that whole month. And You know what the first pass effect is? That's when if you swallow something orally, your liver filters it, you don't get the good effect. But if you put it right up your nose, it goes right into your bloodstream. You get much more of an effect from that drug. So I had a scientific rationale for why I was snorting lines of Ritalin. And I would explain it to you if you cared to ask. So things got really bad. I ended up losing 3 residencies. And the final desperate period of my drinking was in my bottom. I got kicked out of the 3rd residency program. I lost my job, my source of income. I lost my career, my future. I figured 3 strikes was out, and that was probably the truth. I got kicked out of the family practice residency program after getting kicked out of MCV and, you know, and then a smaller residency program in family practice. And that year that I went without drinking, you know, when I finally got kicked out, I took up drinking again, and that day I was just so drunk. It was a bottom. The married girlfriend I had left me because I'd lost my job, and I felt that was unfair. And so I lost my girlfriend, I lost my career, I lost my sobriety. I lost everything that day, and that's my bottom. And that's in 2000, April of 2000, I remember very well. Just a little bit under 2 years before my sobriety date. Those 2 years, I'd say my, you know, during medical school was a haze. These 2 years were miserable. They were truly, truly hell. I had no future. I lived with my parents. I was a physician. I'd managed in that training, those 3 years attempts at residencies, to become a licensed physician. I wasn't a specialist. I was a general physician. I was licensed to do it. I was picking up jobs here and there before I lost them. I had a job for a while. I was working in a prison, and I would smuggle the Ritalin in. And one time, they frisk you. When you're working in a prison as a physician, they frisk you too. And they said, "What are all these pills?" And I said, "Oh, that's Ritalin." And I'd say, well, why are you bringing that in? Oh, it's personal use. You know, I could still be in jail today for that. I could be in prison for that if they would, you know, consider what I was doing was illegal. You know, like the joke I make, if you have to make amends to a warden, you might be an alcoholic. This is where I was. It was a bad thing. I'd come home and be with my parents, and they'd put me up, and it was bad. We had to go to family therapy. It was hard to live with my parents as an active alcoholic. And when I got sober, I had to live with them again. I had to go to family therapy again. It was hard living with a newly sober person. And the therapist would say things like, "I don't have the solution to your problem. Why don't you get your own place to live?" Well, it's not that easy. Don't you understand how hard it is? But that's what it did take. I had to eventually learn how to be autonomous. I didn't know how to do that. But it's just a desperation point. I was 33 years old, living with my parents, had been for the past 2 years. Things were getting truly disgusting. Not these precipitous, calamitous events. I wouldn't get arrested, though I came close one time. I was kind of a home drunk. And a quiet drunk, if I'd like to have that illusion about myself. But what I mean is, I didn't have these great, wonderful opportunities to say, "Oh, that's clearly a reason for your alcoholism." It was just the steady pressure of years of just continued failure. You know, going from, I figure, a high point when I graduated college, I was just, "Oh, God, the world is open to whatever I want to do. Life's great." To where I was brought to, I cannot succeed in life. I can't manage to even have a friend, let alone a girlfriend. I couldn't even look a grown man in the eye. I was so ashamed of myself. I was truly pathetic. And so, you know, what brought me finally to the last drink was, my dad said, "You know, I mourn for you. I'm sorry that your life turned out to be a failure. And I feel bad. I always love you, but if I could divorce you, I would." And drama moment. First time in my life I actually, you know, got down on my knees in a very dramatic way, prayed and said, God help me. And I didn't know if I really meant that or not. I didn't know if I was making a demonstration for him to get out. I didn't have to do that. It wasn't all for him. So there was some genuine, maybe I tried this. Maybe this will work. And a week later when my folks sat me down and said, why don't you quit drinking for the millionth time? And I stop pretending that, you know, it's not a problem. The longest time is, you know, alcohol is not my problem. Don't you understand? You don't understand. I don't have a problem. Everything's okay. I just couldn't see it, and I was totally invested in not being able to see it. Can't get through to an alcoholic if he's not ready. But I was ready, finally, by this point. They said, why don't you quit drinking? And I had no answer. I can't. Wow. And I couldn't. That was the truth. That was the simple answer. All that elaborate, you know, explain my life, why I drink, is nothing. I drink because I can't stop. I couldn't live without alcohol. And I reached the point where I couldn't live with alcohol. I couldn't live. And they had a solution for me. They brought me to the local hospital and the detox. And I introduced myself as a Ritalin addict. And they made an elaborate thing about me. The psychiatrist came in and said, oh, you're a physician, and made a big to-do about me, made me feel special. Sent me down to a place, you know, recovery place for 3 months for physicians and nurses and lawyers and fancy people. Not that I had any money. I didn't need any car money. I didn't have insurance. I didn't have a nice car. I just had that job at the prison. I was making some pretty good money, and I had a nice car. I could see clearly that was going to be repoed pretty soon. And I asked my dad if he'll make payments on my car, and he said, nope. I didn't understand why he won't make payments on my car. Well, I'm doing something for my life. That's not the way it is. And then my parents took a stand. They stopped enabling me, and they said, we're done. And I got better. I went down to that rehab thing, and on the way down there, stopped in a hotel, because it was in Mississippi. I was driving down from Richmond. And, damn if I didn't buy 12 beers and go back for that 6 more. So my sobriety day had changed by a week. And that was my last drink. I remember those last 3 6 packs of beer saying goodbye. I remember it was on the news. I was watching the news, drinking late at night, and I drank 15 of those 18 beers, and I left one of each kind of beer for the maid because she was going to need them. And I went to treatment, and I lied about when the last time I had a drink because I was still saying it was February 8th, even though it was February 16th when I had that drink. Because God knows they won't let you into rehab if you've been drinking. And I got there, and I said, I'm going to do this thing. I'm looking around, looking at my life, and saying, my God, this thing's brought me to rehab. I said to my fellow inmates there, I said, fellas, I'm going to get this thing. I know the statistics. I've heard all that stuff. I know that some people get better, and I'm going to be one of those people. They said, well, that's just the kind of arrogance that indicates you're not going to get better. I said, no. I want to do this, even if it's believing in God, which I've been resistant to, or helping other people, which I don't see the point of yet. Whatever it takes, I'm going to do. And 3 months later, I graduated. And the only people I'd ever met in my life that were sober were in that rehab center. So what I did, I re-upped for another 6 months because I didn't want to leave, because I'd become institutionalized. I didn't know that Alcoholics Anonymous exists outside of a rehab place. I didn't want to drink, and I knew I could not survive on my own. I knew that. And at the end of 9 months, I couldn't stay sober in there. Even though I didn't drink, I knew I was going crazy and I was going to drink. Because my life, you know, you live in a little pretend world when you're in rehab. It's a caricature of life. You know, and how much screen therapy or self-introspection is going to get me better. The only thing that's ever going to get me better is stop the introspection, get out, and live your life. And I finally did. I got out. I joined AA. I did what they told me. They told me that was their AA focus rehab. I confused AA with the rehab, but I talked about AA all the time, went to meetings several times a day, that kind of stuff. But came out in the world, the real world of living with my parents and unemployed, which was going to be continuing for another year and a half. I didn't know that. But I got plugged into a home group, Jaywalkers, in Richmond. And I found people that were very well-versed in taking people through the steps. I got taken through the steps. I started to understand this process. I went through this inventory. I learned about myself. I was willing to accept my character defects were based on the fact that I'm ego-driven. I'm afraid. I'm self-centered and selfish, self-centered, dishonest. I understood that I could accept that all this stuff, this embarrassing stuff, whatever. I didn't have anything. I was a lightweight when it comes to embarrassing stories, too. I'd throw one up in my laundry, looking through which one was not very much puked on. I could wear that piece of clothing. That's about as pathetic as you can get. I was going to take that one to my grave, but that's just pathetic. And I got through these eighth and ninth steps. And I got to the ninth step, and I made amends to that warden. I'd stolen her umbrella, so when I went back, I brought her an umbrella. So I got an umbrella for you, and I have to tell you why I was such a bad employee. I was a drunk. I didn't tell her about the Ritalin because that might have led to some legal consequences. It wasn't the point. The point I owed her an amends for being a bad employee, and I did. And I came to have a relationship with this warden who came to see that Alcoholics Anonymous is the solution. That's what a real amends was about. How do I change and really be an example of someone who can be really transformed? They get on board and they say, "Oh my God, this thing really is a transformation." It took a while. I said I was unemployed for a year and a half, and I was trying to get jobs. And I'd go to these pizza places, and they'd say, "You're a physician. You're overqualified." I said, "I understand. I'll take you $6 an hour, whatever it is." And they said, "No, you are overqualified. You're not going to stay." I said, "Yeah." And they wouldn't hire me. And I'd go try to get a physician job. And they said, "With your track record, I don't think we need to hire you." And it was really hard. And about 2 years into sobriety, between a year and a half and 2 years, I'd been through the 12 steps. I was doing everything I could possibly do in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, I ended up going to 1,000 meetings in 1,000 days. I was doing everything. I thought it was about going to many, many meetings. And I was trying to sponsor guys. In fact, when Mark came in from up North Carolina and I met him, I said, "Well, you need a sponsor." He ended up being my sponsor, but that's great. I was trying, and I was doing this 11th step. I was working on that prayer and meditation, and what am I doing wrong? I did three, four steps, because something's missing here. I don't get it. Stop at 12, because is there something more to life? I'm still living with my parents and unemployed, and how much of a farce can this AA really be? How long can they sit around and tell each other how wonderful it is when the truth is I'm still miserable? Okay, I get it that it's better than it was. And I feel good for a while in a meeting talking about how good things are. And I still have some hope that some of these people really are telling the truth, that their lives really has been transformed. But damn it, my parents don't see it. And I have to go face them at the end of the day. And they're wondering why they had to drop me off at an AA meeting. And isn't that selfish, to go off to an AA meeting and think about me, when all I've ever done my whole life was think about me? And my sponsor, my now sponsor, it wasn't at the time, became my sponsor, said, let's think about what this 12th step really looks like. What does it really mean? Otherwise, it's just a joke. You're going to AA meetings, talking the talk, and you're not walking the walk. Let's talk about not going to so many meetings. I said, "Whoa, hold on. You're talking about not going to so many meetings. Yeah, how about not going to so many meetings and focus on life in order?" And that's a true ninth step. Let's talk about a real 12th step, which is practice these principles in all our affairs and make this thing work. Because the real point of all this thing is that fifth tradition, the primary purpose is to help the other person, which is the third of that 12th step, which is, carry this message to other alcoholics who suffer. That is the point. And if you're willing to accept that it's not for you, it's for the next guy, and it's not for him, it's for the next guy behind him, then anybody who gets in on that will enjoy what this program has to offer. So, wow. You're talking some radical stuff here now. So I threw myself into the next right thing, which is stop pretending to myself that I'm really trying to get a job and treat it for what it is, life or death. If I'm not self-supporting like it says in the Southern tradition, I'm not practicing these principles, then I'm not doing AA. And getting a job is AA, because I need to be self-supporting, and I need to get a job to do that. And I throw myself full into getting a job, and I did that. And I put out all these applications all over town, and I'm still getting responses on, why did you wait 4 years to respond? And I was just trying. I was putting myself out there. I'm going to be a doctor. I am not qualified to be a doctor. I'm being honest with myself now. And the truth is, I faked it through medical school. There's serious holes in my medical knowledge. I'm probably a danger. I know I'm a danger. And my sponsor happens to be a physician. He explained to me that that's not quite the way this thing works. If you really want to put yourself in God's hands, it's going to make this thing work for you. So, wow. So, I don't know how long it took for me to get completely desperate. Like, just look at the alcoholism. I'm desperate in terms of getting the job. I put out all these applications. I don't know what's happening. I got on the phone with this other guy from AA, sober 15 years, and talks great in meetings. I called him up. I just started crying my head off. I was like, I am putting myself out there. I can't get a job, and I'll be willing to be a hairdresser. I don't care what, but I'm powerless. I cannot get a job. Dang it, in the middle of that conversation, the phone rings, and someone who had not put an application out here said, well, we're calling from Waynesboro. We have an urgent care center here. We need a physician. Would you like this job? Like, holy crap. Oh, my God, are you kidding me? I had to call a guy back and say, okay, God really does exist. This is weird. I'm here complaining. I'm hitting the bottom about how I'm unemployed. And this person, I didn't apply. I swear to you, I didn't apply to them. And they called me and said, we have a job for you. And I started my new life as a physician. I talked to my sponsor. He's a physician. I said, I don't think I know how to do stitches. I don't know how to. And he laughs and he says, you remember when you didn't know how to do stitches? He said, just do it. You know how to do this. You learned. They're in a problem that I can't solve with the resources that I have. In other words, I'm not alone. There's something over my head medically. There's a hospital nearby, right? I'm not alone. I have people I can consult. I'm not doing this by myself. I learned how to be honest and say, I don't know. There's a lot you can learn from nurses that have been doing this for 30 years. If you tell them you admit you don't know, they'll tell you. And I learned how to practice medicine. I got a series of jobs, and always moving up. And working for less and less corrupt people. My jobs were kind of bottom of the barrel, the kind of people that would call me up and say, we need a physician. A few years back, I was working for this guy. I had to leave and just walk away, you know, without a job. But he was making me do stuff that I was refusing to do. Be responsible for 3 nursing homes, but not giving me any time to go see those patients. That's unethical, illegal, and harmful to me, as well as those people. So I walked away. I didn't care, but I cared, but I didn't, you know, let the threat of him suing me affect that. I needed to do the right thing. And I see that now that was a great thing. He made me go do these nursing homes, and that's funny. That's what I do now. when I did that job, I learned that I could be a nursing home physician. I'm still not a board certified doctor. I'm heading back towards that. But last year I made above the median income for internal medicine physicians. I just accepted another job as medical director in Williamsburg. I'm the medical director of several places. I've built a reputation as a good, conscientious, caring doctor who answers his own phone. I don't have to get jobs anymore. They call me up and say, this is a wonderful thing about it. You can work for us. That's an amazing thing. But that's kind of the side effect. But it's also, I've got to do this because it's not for me. I've got to do something that's attractive. I'm going to carry a message of, you don't have to live like this. You can live like this. I've got to have something that appeals. I'll tell you, you know, my sponsor, he lost his license for a while and went back, and they made him a professor of medicine, so he did a good job. That holds real depth and weight for me. That's secretly what I want. You know, I'll tell you what my honest, secret desires in life, all I want is to play in a symphony and be a professor of medicine. That's it. That's not too much. You know, I'd never admit that because that's like so much. You know, like what kind of grandiose person am I? I'm not a humble person if I say I want to be a professor of medicine and play in a symphony. You know, on a personal note, that's happening. I mean, I don't know where it stands right now in terms of the career, but it's getting so much better that I know I'm heading in a great direction. I'm self-sufficient as a physician. And I'm taking horn lessons now. I'm playing better than I ever have in my life. I'm taking lessons with the guy who plays first chair in the Richard Symphony. He's pretty impressed with me. It's going great. It's an amazing thing. So, but it's not for me. This is 12-step work. I get to partake of this because I'm really living it so that I can effectively say to the next guy, you know, I'm telling you the truth when I say there's more than just going to meetings and talking about how life can be. This is truly a way of life. So now it brings you to the main point. Is it 5 till? So I've got 6 minutes to talk to you about what I really wanted to talk to you all along, which is our home group and what we do. Called into action. I mean, we started our home group 3 years ago, branched off from another group. I don't know, Mark wasn't really, I mean, he came up from North Carolina, and Tom, I was his sponsor down there, and he got well grounded and great AA from there. And felt the need to start a home group. I was just looking, 3 years ago, we started a home group, about 8 of us. I know the location of a couple of guys who are the original founding members of those. And other than that, I don't know where the rest of them are. Of those 8 guys, 2 of us are still sober and in the home group. That's just 3 years. So that's the disease we're talking about. But it's called inaction. It's based on action. Some of the projects that we do, the next couple of months are going to be about 70 nursing students. All the nursing students that go to Medical College of Virginia come through a home group as part of their training. They have a relationship. This is all my sponsor. He's amazing. We've done all this stuff. So the nursing students, this is part of the CPC, Cooperation of the Professional Community. The nursing students learn that they are on the front lines of alcoholism, not us. We're stuck in meetings, right? We're having a relationship with these people, the ministers, the doctors, the judges, the people who come into contact with alcoholics in crisis. That's when the magic happens. When the crisis is put into contact with the solution, which is us, that's when somebody can be transformed. If the solution is there and there's no crisis, you're hearing deaf ears. So the nursing students are learning that. They learn that they're important for us. We need them. And that alcoholism really does represent a terrible, terrible toll, you know, it is a terror on society. And they, you know, it's their responsibility to do something about alcoholism, especially if they know that there's a solution. So we have a relationship with them. We have a relationship with a residency program. So the doctors, as they become family practice doctors, come to our home group. It's just about to start, and learn about, you know, the medical recommendation for alcoholism is Alcoholics Anonymous. Did you know that? The medical community says that we are the solution, not them. Not that we, you know, try to play doctor when it comes to treating their bleeding esophageal varices or something. Leave the medicine up to the doctors. But when it comes to treating the spiritual disease, we are the experts. We are the alcoholics. We have found something that we share, and that's our primary purpose. So CPC is going strong. We got a bunch of ministers on board. And when guys say, I can't do Alcoholics Anonymous because, you know, when I got to the third step, I realized God will do everything for me, and so I'm going to go to church. Well, when his pastor says, you know what, I talked to those AA guys, I think you should go there. Yeah. And when his own pastor saying, that's fine, you can do both. We suggest the alcoholics go to Alcoholics Anonymous. and they don't have that out. No, I'm God. No, I'm not going to do AA. I'm going to do God instead. It makes, public information is amazing. Jim's our PI chairperson. He's just, we've done so much. We started with a little business card. We have a little interaction card. We have our own home group cell phone, so our own number. If you want to call it, you can reach us. The pamphlet racks at the free clinics and the little sign out in front of our thing. The last 5 weeks, we did a weekly one-hour television show. I got a chance to... one person that not identified as an alcoholic, but just a physician, I got a chance to do two of those, and Mark did three of them. And then the back of three guys says, I'm here as a physician, tell you a little bit of alcoholism. I've got some anonymous members of Alcoholics Anonymous to talk to you. It was a one-hour cable TV show. We did it for 5 weeks, and we're discussing whether to do it on a more permanent basis next year. So we have our own website. PI is exciting to get that message out there that we're serious. this is the only way we've ever been happy is when we're excited about something like this. Man, this is great stuff. People come on board and say, God, you guys are not just talking in meetings about how life is so, well, it's not great, but it's better than it was. We don't talk like that at all. Life is pretty darn good. So that we do the corrections stuff. We go to the local jail, establish the relationship with the prison, that somehow AA had never been able to get a foothold in there until we really looked at it and said, this is important, and we kind of focus on that. We need to get this warden on board. This is important. It would be just, it's wrong not to have people in the community on board about the solution. If at least two-thirds of all incarcerated inmates are alcoholic, to not provide that solution would be criminal, wouldn't it? So we don't have to get that strong with the word. We show up and he sees that we're serious and says, yeah, I'm supportive. That's all it really takes, is that he sees that we're serious. We're not the people that just show up when we feel like it. It's important to us. And of course, there's the PI, public information, cooperation with the professional community, and then there's the corrections, and then the treatment. We go to the local treatment centers. One of the major treatment centers is more like a homeless shelter in Richmond, calls itself AA, and mandates that all these guys go to meetings. They have 300 people there, and they kind of, if they come as a group, they can overwhelm a group. So it's been a real interesting thing to try to talk to other groups around town. How do you deal with this problem of a major treatment center kind of swarming you? And you have more new guys than sober guys, and turn off the sober guys, and God, it can be a difficult thing. It's been a process. We decide we go in every Monday night, we talk to them. We're not bringing a meeting there. We're going to talk to you about Alcoholics Anonymous. When you get out, Come join us. While you're still in there, you can develop this transition thing, and you can learn about AA is not about a treatment center. I told you about my experience, AA in a treatment center. I thought that AA was a treatment center. No, AA is, my sponsor describes it to me, AA is the opposite of a cult. A cult asks you to quit your job, believe this dogma about religion or about whatever, who's in control, it's just called politics or whatever, and takes you away from your life. A is the opposite. A says you can believe whatever you want. It's a purely voluntary organization. It will get you back into your life. It makes you a better employee, a better father, a better husband, a better whatever. And gets your life back. So it's the opposite of a cult. It's not like my parents said, why are you going to all these AA meetings and not doing your life? Well, that's what I was doing. I was missing that. I was missing the part of AA where the spiritual awakening is, where we finally realize and fully accept that my life only works when I'm engaged in helping another person. That's where that power comes in, to help me help that other person. Otherwise, I got no power. And that's what that spiritual awakening is. That's the only time life works for me. And that's the same simple message. When I used to have problems that were too big for AA, I didn't understand that. And I am doing a good job of ending exactly on time, so I've got 5 more seconds. And so I just want to say thank you for inviting me here.